and Caris were left alone. He moved to sit on the bench next to her and kissed her. She said, "I'm so proud of you." He glowed. He was proud of himself. He kissed her again, this time with a long, moist kiss that gave him an erection. He touched her breast through the linen of her robe, squeezing her nipple gently with his fingertips. She touched his erection and giggled. "Do you want me to bring you off?" she whispered. She did that sometimes late in the evening, when her father and Petronilla were asleep, and Merthin and she were alone on the ground floor of the house. But this was broad daylight, and someone could walk in at any moment. "No," he said. "I could do it quickly." She tightened her grasp. "I'm too embarrassed." He stood up and moved to the other side of the table. "I'm sorry." "Well, maybe we won't have to do this much longer." "Do what?" "Hide, and worry about people walking in." She looked hurt. "Don't you like it?" "Of course I do. But it would be nicer for us to be alone. I could take a house, now that I'm getting paid." "You've only been paid once." "That's true. But you seem very pessimistic all of a sudden. Have I said something wrong?"
"No, but why do you want to change the way things are?"
He was baffled by this question. "I just want more of the same, in private." She looked defiant.
"I'm happy now."
"Well, so am I. But nothing goes on forever."
"Why not?"
He felt as if he were explaining something to a child. "Because we can't spend the rest of our lives living with our parents and stealing kisses when no one's looking. We have to get a home of our own, and live as man and wife, and sleep together every night, and have real sex instead of bringing each other off, and raise a family."
"Why?"
she said.
"I don't know why,"
he said in exasperation.
"That's the way it is, and I'm not going to try to explain any more, because I think you're determined not to understand, or at least to pretend you don't understand."
"All right. And besides, I have to go back to work."
"Go on, then."
This was incomprehensible. He had been frustrated during the last half year by not being able to marry Caris, and he had assumed she felt the same. Now, it seemed, she did not. Indeed, she resented his assumption. But did she really believe that they could continue this adolescent relationship indefinitely? He looked at her, trying to read her face, and saw only a sulky obstinacy there. He turned away and went out through the door. He hesitated on the street outside. Perhaps he should go back in and make her say what was on her mind. But remembering the look on her face, he knew this was not the moment to try to make her do anything. So he walked on, heading for St. Mark's, thinking, "How did such a wonderful day turn so bad?" Chapter 22 Godwin was preparing Kingsbridge Cathedral for the big wedding. The church had to look its best. In addition to the Earl of Monmouth and the Earl of Shiring, there would be several barons and hundreds of knights in attendance. Broken flagstones had to be replaced, chipped masonry repaired, crumbling mouldings carved anew, walls whitewashed, pillars painted, and everything scrubbed clean. "And I want the repairs to the south aisle of the chancel finished," Godwin said to Elfric as they walked through the church.
"I'm not sure that's possible."
"It must be done. We can't have scaffolding in the chancel during a wedding of this importance." He saw Philemon waving urgently at him from the south transept door.
"Excuse me."
"I haven't got the men," Elfric called after him. "You shouldn't be so quick to sack them," Godwin said over his shoulder. Philemon was looking excited.
"Friar Murdo is asking to see the Earl," he said.
"Good." Petronilla had spoken to the friar last night, and this morning Godwin had instructed Philemon to lurk near the hospital and watch out for Murdo. He had been expecting an early visit. He hurried to the hospital, with Philemon in tow. He was relieved to see that Murdo was still waiting in the big room on the ground floor. The fat friar had smartened up his appearance. His face and hands were clean. The fringe of hair around his tonsure was combed, and he had sponged the worst of the stains off his robe. He did not look like a prior, but he almost looked like a monk. Godwin ignored him and went up the stairs. Standing guard outside the Earl's room, he saw Merthyn's brother, Ralph, who was one of the Earl's squires. Ralph was handsome, except for a broken nose, a recent injury. Squires were always breaking bones. "Hello, Ralph," Godwin said amiably. "What's happened to your nose?"
"I had a fight with a peasant bastard."
"You should have got it set properly. Did that friar come up here?"
"Yes. They asked him to wait."
"Who's with the Earl?"
"Lady Philippa and the clerk, Father Jeremy."
"Ask if they'll see me."
"Lady Philippa says the Earl must not see anyone."
Godwin gave Ralph a man-to-man grin. "But she's only a woman." Ralph grinned back, then opened the door and put his head inside. "Brother Godwin, the sacrist?" he said. There was a pause, and then Lady Philippa stepped out and closed the door behind her.
"I told you no visitors,"
she said angrily. "Earl Rowland is not getting the rest he needs." Ralph said,
"I know, my lady, but Brother Godwin wouldn't bother the Earl unnecessarily."
Something in Ralph's tone made Godwin look at him. Although Ralph's words were mundane, the expression on his face was adoring. Godwin noticed, then, how voluptuous Philippa was. She wore a dark red dress belted at the waist, and the fine wool clung to her breasts and hips. She looked like a statue representing temptation, Godwin thought, and he wished yet again that he could find a way to ban women from the priory. It was bad enough if a squire fell in love with a married woman, but for a monk to do the same would be a catastrophe.
"I regret the need to trouble the Earl," Godwin said, "but there's a friar waiting downstairs to see him."
"I know. Murdo. Is his business so urgent?"
"On the contrary, but I need to forewarn the Earl what to expect."
"So you know what the friar is going to say?"
"I believe I do."
"Well, I think it's best if the two of you see the Earl together."
Godwin said,
"But..." then pretended to stifle a protest. Philippa looked at Ralph.
"Get the friar up here, please."
Ralph summoned Murdo, and Philippa ushered him and Godwin into the room. Earl Rowland was on the bed, fully dressed as before, but this time he was sitting up, his bandaged head cushioned with feather pillows.
"What's this?" he said with his usual bad temper. "A meeting of the chapter? What do you monks want?"
Looking at his visage directly for the first time since the bridge collapse, Godwin was shocked to see that the entire right side of his face was paralyzed. The eyelid drooped, the cheek hardly moved, and the mouth was slack. What made it so startling was that the left side was animated. When Roland spoke, the left side of his forehead frowned, his left eye opened wide and seemed to blaze with authority, and he spoke vehemently out of the left side of his mouth. The doctor in Godwin was fascinated. He knew that head injuries could have unpredictable effects, but he had never heard of this particular manifestation.
"Don't gawk at me,"
the Earl said impatiently. "You look like a pair of cows staring over a hedge. State your business."
Godwin pulled himself together. He had to tread carefully over the next few minutes. He knew that Roland would reject Murdo's application to be nominated as prior. All the same, he wanted to plant in Roland's mind the idea of Murdo as a possible alternative to Saul Whitehead. Therefore, Godwin's job was to strengthen Murdo's application. He would do this, paradoxically, by objecting to Murdo, thereby showing Roland that Murdo would owe no allegiance to the monks, for Roland wanted a prior who served him alone. But on the other hand, Godwin must not protest too strongly, for he did not want the Earl to realize what a truly hopeless candidate Murdo actually was. It was a tortuous path to walk. Murdo spoke first, in his sonorous, pulpit voice.
"My lord, I come to ask you to consider me for the position of Prior of Kingsbridge. I believe...
Not so loud, for the love of the saints!
Roland protested. Murdo lowered his voice.
My lord, I believe that I... Why do you want to be prior?
Roland said, interrupting him again.
I thought a friar was a monk without a church, by definition.
This point of view was old-fashioned. Friars originally were travellers who held no property. But nowadays, some of the fraternal orders were as wealthy as traditional monks. Roland knew this and was just being provocative. Murdo gave the standard answer.
I believe that God accepts both forms of sacrifice. So you're willing to turn your coat.
I have come to think that the talents he gave me could be put to better use in a priory. So yes, I would be happy to embrace the rule of St. Benedict.
But why should I consider you?
I am also an ordained priest.
No shortage of those.
And I have a following in Kingsbridge and the surrounding countryside such that, if I may be allowed to boast, I must be the most influential man of God in the area.
Father Jerome spoke for the first time. He was a confident young man with an intelligent face, and Godwin sensed that he was ambitious. It's true, he said. The friar is extraordinarily popular. He was not popular with the monks, of course, but neither Roland nor Jerome knew that, and Godwin was not about to enlighten them. Nor was Murdo. He bowed his head and said unctuously,
I thank you from my heart, Father Jerome.
Godwin said, He is popular with the ignorant multitude.
As was our Saviour,
Murdo shot back. Monks should lead lives of poverty and self-denial, Godwin said. Roland put in,
The friar's clothes look poor enough. And as for self-denial, it seems to me that Kingsbridge monks eat better than many peasants.
Friar Murdo has been seen drunk in taverns, Godwin protested.
Murdo said, St. Benedict's rule permits monks to drink wine.
Only if they are sick or labouring in the fields.
I preach in the fields.
Murdo was a formidable opponent in an argument, Godwin noted. He was glad that he did not actually want to win this one. He turned to Roland. All I can say is that as the sacrist here, I strongly counsel your lordship against nominating Murdo as Prior of Kingsbridge.
Noted, Roland said coldly.
Philippa gave Godwin a look of mild surprise, and he realized he had yielded a little too easily. But Roland had not noticed. He did not deal in nuances. Murdo had not finished.
The Prior of Kingsbridge must serve God, of course. But in all things temporal, he should be guided by the king, and the king's earls and barons.
That was about as plain as could be, Godwin thought. Murdo might as well have said, I will be your man. It was an outrageous declaration. The monks would be horrified. It would wipe out any support there might have been among them for Murdo's candidacy. Godwin made no comment, but Roland looked inquiringly at him.
Anything to say to that, sacrist?
I'm sure the friar did not mean to say that the Priory of Kingsbridge should be in subjection to the Earl of Shiring in any matter, temporal or otherwise. Did you, Murdo?
I have said what I have said.
Murdo replied in his pulpit voice.
Enough, said Roland, bored now with the game. You're wasting your time, both of you. I shall nominate Saul Whitehead. Off you go.
St. John in the Forest was a miniature version of Kingsbridge Priory. The church was small, as were the stone-built cloisters and dormitory, and the rest of the buildings were simple wood-frame structures. There were 8 monks and no nuns. In addition to their lives of prayer and meditation,
They grew most of their own food and made a goat's cheese that was famous throughout southwest England. Godwin and Philemon had been riding for 2 days, and it was early evening when the road emerged from the forest and they saw a wide acreage of cleared land with the church in the middle. Godwin knew at once that his fears were true, and reports that Saul Whitehead was doing a good job as prior of this cell were, if anything, understated. There was a look of order and neatness about everything. The hedges trimmed, the ditches straight, the trees planted at measured intervals in the orchard, the fields of ripening grain free of weeds. He felt sure he would find that the services were held at the correct times and conducted reverently. He had to hope that Saul's evident fitness for leadership had not made him ambitious. As they rode along the path through the fields, Philemon said, "Why is the Earl so keen to make his cousin Prior of Kingsbridge?" "For the same reason that he had his younger son made Bishop of Kingsbridge," Godwin replied. "Bishops and priors are powerful. The Earl wants to make sure that any influential man in his neighborhood is an ally, not an enemy. What might they quarrel about?" Godwin was interested to see that young Philemon was beginning to be intrigued by the chess game of power politics. "Land, taxes, rights, privileges. For example, the prior might want to build a new bridge at Kingsbridge to bring more business to the Fleece Fair, and the Earl might oppose such a scheme on the grounds that it would take business away from his own fair at Shiring. But I don't really see how the prior could fight against the Earl. A prior has no soldiers. A clergyman can influence the mass of the people. If he preaches a sermon against the Earl, or calls upon the saints to bring misfortune to the Earl, people will begin to believe that the Earl is cursed. Then they will discount his power, mistrust him, and expect all his projects to be doomed. It can be very hard for a nobleman to oppose a truly determined cleric. Look what happened to King Henry II after the murder of Thomas Becket." They rode into the farmyard and dismounted. The horses immediately drank from the trough. There was no one about but a monk with his robe hitched up, mucking out a pigsty behind the stables. He was sure to be a youngster doing a job like that. Godwin called to him. "Hey, you, lad! Come and help us with our horses." "Righto," the monk called back. He finished cleaning out the sty with a few more passes of his rake, then leaned the tool up against the stable wall and walked towards the newcomers. Godwin was about to tell him to get a move on when he recognized the blonde fringe of Saul. Godwin disapproved. A prior should not muck out a pigsty. Ostentatious humility was, after all, ostentation. However, in this case, Saul's meekness might suit Godwin's purpose. He gave Saul a friendly smile. "Hello, brother. I didn't mean to order the prior to unsaddle my horse." "Why not?" said Saul. "Someone must do it, and you've been traveling all day." Saul led the horses into the stable. "The brothers are in the fields," he called out. "But they'll be back soon for evensong." He re-emerged. "Come into the kitchen." They had never been close. Godwin could not help feeling criticized by Saul's piety. Saul was never unfriendly, but with quiet determination he simply did things differently. Godwin had to take care not to become irritated. He felt stressed enough already. Godwin and Philemon followed Saul across the farmyard and into a one-story building with a high roof. Although made of wood, it had a stone fireplace and chimney. They sat gratefully on a rough bench at a scrubbed table. Saul drew 2 generous cups of ale from a large barrel. He sat opposite them. Philemon drank thirstily, but Godwin just sipped. Saul offered no food, and Godwin guessed they would get nothing more until after evensong. He felt too tense to eat, anyway. This was another delicate moment, he reflected anxiously. He had had to protest against Murdo's nomination in such a way as not to dissuade Roland. Now he had to invite Saul to stand in a way that he could not possibly accept. He knew what he was going to say, but he had to say it right. If he made a false step, Saul would become suspicious, and then anything could happen. Saul gave him no time for further worry. "What brings you here, brother?" he said. "Earl Roland has recovered his wits. I thank God. This means we can hold the election for prior."
"Good.
We should not go too long without one." "But who should it be?" Saul sidestepped the question.
"Have any names been put forward?"
"Brother Thomas, the matricularius."
"He'd be a good manager."
"No one else." Godwin told a half-truth. "Not formally."
"What about Carlos? When I came to Kingsbridge for Prior Anthony's funeral, the sub-prior was the leading candidate."
"He feels he is not capable of the job."
"Because of his blindness?"
"Perhaps." Saul did not know about Carlos falling over during the service for St. Adolphus's birthday. Godwin decided not to tell him. "At any rate, he has thought and prayed about it and made his decision."
"Has the Earl not made a nomination?"
"He's thinking about it." Godwin hesitated. "That's why we're here. The Earl is considering nominating you."
This was not really a lie, Godwin told himself, just a misleading emphasis. "I'm honored."
Godwin studied him. "But not completely surprised, perhaps?" Saul flushed.
"Forgive me. The great Philip was in charge here at St. John and then became prior of Kingsbridge, and others have followed the same route. That is not to say that I'm worthy as they were, of course.
But the thought had crossed my mind, I confess." "Nothing to be ashamed of. How would you feel about being nominated?"
"How would I feel?"
Saul seemed mystified.
"Why ask that? If the Earl wishes, he will nominate me. And if my brethren want me, they'll vote for me. And I will consider myself called by God. It makes no difference how I feel about it."
This was not the answer Godwin wanted. He needed Saul to make up his own mind. Talk of God's will was counterproductive.
"It's not quite so simple," he said. "You don't have to accept the nomination. That's why the Earl sent me here."
"It's not like Roland to ask where he might command."
Godwin almost winced. "Never forget how shrewd Saul is," he told himself. He backpedaled hastily.
"No, indeed. However, if you think you might refuse, he needs to know as soon as possible, so that he can nominate someone else."
That was probably true, though Roland had not said it.
"I didn't realize it was done this way."
It was not done this way, Godwin thought. But he said, "Last time it happened, when Prior Anthony was elected, you and I were both novices, so we didn't know what went on."
"True."
"Do you feel you have the ability to fill the role of Prior of Kingsbridge?"
"Certainly not."
"Ah." Godwin pretended disappointment, though he had been relying on Saul's humility to produce that answer.
"However..."
"What?"
"With God's help, who knows what might be accomplished."
"How true." Godwin concealed his annoyance. The humble answer had just been a formality. The truth was that Saul thought he could do the job. "Of course, you should reflect and pray about it tonight."
"I'm sure I'll think of little else."
They heard distant voices. "The brothers are returning from their work." "We can talk again in the morning," Godwin said. "If you decide to be a candidate, you must come back to Kingsbridge with us."
"Very well."
There was a serious danger of Saul's accepting, Godwin feared, but he had one more arrow to shoot. "Something else you might bear in mind in your prayers," he said. "A nobleman never offers a free gift." Saul looked worried.
"What do you mean?"
"Earls and barons dispense titles, land, positions, monopolies, but these things always have a price."
"And in this case?"
"If you are elected, Roland will expect you to make recompense. You are his cousin, anyway, and you'll owe your position to him. You will be his voice in chapter,
making sure the Priory's actions don't interfere with his interests. Will he make that an explicit condition of the nomination? Explicit? No. But when you return with me to Kingsbridge, he will question you, and the questions will be designed to reveal your intentions. If you insist that you will be an independent prior, showing no special favor to your cousin and sponsor, he will nominate someone else. I had not thought of that. Of course, you may simply give him the answers he wants to hear and then change your mind after the election. But that would be dishonest. Some would think so. God would think so. That's something for you to pray about tonight. A group of young monks came into the kitchen, muddy from the fields, talking loudly. And Saul got up to serve the meal, but the worried look remained on his face. It stayed there when they went into the little church, with its wall painting of the Day of Judgment over the altar, for evensong. It was still there when, at last, the evening meal was served, and Godwin's hunger was assuaged by the delicious cheese the monks made. Godwin lay awake that night, although he ached from 2 days on horseback. He had confronted Saul with an ethical dilemma. Most monks would have been willing to shade their position while talking to Roland, and speak words which promised a degree of subservience to the Earl much greater than they really intended. But not Saul. He was driven by moral imperatives. Would he find a way through the dilemma and accept the nomination? Godwin did not see how he could. Saul still wore the worried look when the monks got up at first light for the service of lords. After breakfast, he told Godwin he could not accept the nomination. Godwin could not get used to Earl Roland's face. It was the strangest thing to look at. The Earl was now wearing a hat to cover the bandages on his head, but by making his appearance more normal, the hat emphasized the paralysis of the right side of his face. Roland also seemed even more bad-tempered than usual, and Godwin guessed he was still suffering severe headaches. "Where is my cousin Saul?" he said as soon as Godwin walked into the room. "Still at St. John, my lord. I gave him your message."
"Message? It was a command!"
Lady Philippa, standing beside the bed, said softly, "Don't excite yourself, lord. You know it makes you feel ill." Godwin said, "Brother Saul simply said that he cannot accept the nomination."
"Why the devil not?"
"He thought and prayed."
"Of course he prayed. That's what monks do."
"What reason did he give for defying me?" "He does not feel himself capable of such a challenging role."
"Nonsense. What challenge? He's not being asked to lead 1,000 knights into battle. Just make sure a handful of monks sing their hymns at the right times of day."
That was rubbish, so Godwin bowed his head and said nothing. The Earl's tone changed suddenly.
"I've just realized who you are. You're the son of Petronilla, aren't you?"
"Yes, lord. That's Petronilla whom you jilted," Godwin thought.
"She was sly, and I'll bet you are, too. How do I know you didn't talk Saul out of accepting? You want Thomas Langley to be prior, don't you?"
"My plan is a lot more devious than that, you fool," Godwin thought. He said, "Saul did ask me what you might want in return for nominating him."
"Ah, now we come to it. What did you tell him?"
"That you would expect him to listen to one who was his cousin, his sponsor, and his earl?"
"And he was too pig-headed to accept that, I suppose. Right, that settles it. I shall nominate that fat friar. Now, get out of my sight."
Godwin had to hide his elation as he bowed out of the room. The penultimate stage of his plan had worked perfectly. Earl Roland had not the least suspicion of how he had been nudged into nominating the most hopeless candidate Godwin could think of. Now for the final step. He left the hospital and entered the cloisters. It was the hour of study before the midday service of Sext, and most of the monks were standing or sitting around reading, being read to, or meditating.
Godwin spotted Theodoric, his young ally, and summoned him with a jerk of the head. In a low voice he said, "Earl Roland has nominated Friar Murdo as prior." Theodoric said loudly,
"What? Hush! It's impossible!"
"Of course it is.
No one will vote for him.
That's why I'm pleased."
Understanding dawned on Theodoric's face.
"Oh, I see. So it's good for us, really."
Godwin wondered why he always had to explain these things, even to intelligent men. No one saw below the surface except him and his mother. Go around telling everyone, quietly. No need to show your outrage. They'll get angry enough without encouragement. Should I say that this is good for Thomas? Absolutely not.
Right, said Theodoric. I understand.
He evidently did not, but Godwin felt he could be trusted to follow instructions. Godwin left him and went in search of Philemon. He found him sweeping out the refectory.
"Do you know where Murdo is?" he asked.
"Probably in the kitchen.
Find him, and ask him to meet you in the prior's house when all the monks are in church for sext. I don't want anyone to see you there with him."
"All right. What do I tell him?"
"First of all, you say, 'Brother Murdo, no one must ever know that I told you this.'
Is that clear?"
"No one must ever know that I told you this."
"All right.
Then show him the charter we found. You remember where it is?
In the bedroom beside the prie-dieu. There's a chest with a ginger-coloured leather wallet inside.
Is that all?"
"Point out that the land Thomas brought to the priory belonged originally to Queen Isabella, and that this fact has been kept secret for 10 years.
Philemon looked puzzled. "But we don't know what Thomas is trying to hide."
"No. But there's always a reason for a secret.
Don't you think Murdo will try to use this information against Thomas?"
"Of course."
"What will Murdo do?"
"I don't know, but whatever it is, it's sure to be bad for Thomas."
Philemon frowned.
"I thought we were supposed to be helping Thomas."
Godwin smiled. "That's what everyone thinks." The bell rang for sext. Philemon went off in search of Murdo, and Godwin joined the rest of the monks in church. In unison with the others he said, "O God, incline unto mine aid." On this occasion he prayed with unusual earnestness. Despite the confidence he had shown Philemon, he knew he was gambling. He had staked everything on Thomas's secret, but he did not know what the face of the card would show when he turned it up. However, it was clear he had succeeded in stirring up the monks. They were restless and talkative, and Carlos had to call for quiet twice during the psalms. They disliked friars in general for taking an attitude of moral superiority on the question of earthly possessions, while, at the same time, sponging off those they condemned. And they disliked Murdo in particular for being pompous, greedy, and drunk. They would have anyone rather than him. As they left the church after the service, Simeon spoke to Godwin.
"We cannot have the friar," he said.
"I agree. Carlos and I will not be putting forward another name. If the monks appear divided, the earl will be able to present his candidate as a necessary compromise. We must sink our differences and rally round Thomas. If we show the world a united front, it will be difficult for the earl to oppose us."
Godwin stopped and faced Simeon.
"Thank you, brother," he said,
forcing himself to look humble and hide the exultation he felt.
"We're doing it for the good of the priory."
"I know, but I appreciate your generosity of spirit."
Simeon nodded and walked away. Godwin smelled victory. The monks went into the refectory for dinner. Murdo joined them. He missed services, but not meals. All monasteries had a general rule that any monk or friar was welcomed at the table, though few people exploited the practice as thoroughly as Murdo. Godwin studied his face. The friar looked excited, as if he had news he was bursting to share. However, he contained himself while dinner was served, and remained silent throughout the meal, listening to a novice read. The passage chosen was the story of Susanna and the Elders. Godwin disapproved. The story was too sexy to be read aloud in a celibate community. But today even the attempts of two lascivious old men to blackmail a woman into having sex with them failed to capture the monk's attention. They kept whispering among themselves, looking sidelong at Murdo. When the food was finished, and the prophet Daniel had saved Susanna from execution by interrogating the elders separately and showing that they told inconsistent stories, the monks got ready to leave. At that moment, Murdo spoke to Thomas.
"When you came here, Brother Thomas, you had a sword wound, I believe."
He spoke loudly enough for everyone to hear, and the other monk stopped to listen. Thomas looked at him stonily.
"Yes." "The wound that eventually caused you to lose your left arm. I wonder, did you receive that wound in the service of Queen Isabella?"
Thomas turned pale. "I've been a monk of Kingsbridge for 10 years. My previous life is forgotten." Murdo carried on unperturbed.
"I ask because of the parcel of land that you brought with you when you joined the priory. A very productive little village in Norfolk. 500 acres. Near Lynn, where the Queen lives."
Godwin interrupted, pretending to be indignant. "What does an outsider know of our property?"
"Oh, I've read the charter," Murdo said. "These things aren't secret."
Godwin looked at Carlos and Simeon, sitting side by side. Both men looked startled. As sub-prior and treasurer, they knew already. They must be wondering how Murdo had got sight of the deed. Simeon opened his mouth to speak.
Murdo said, "Or at least, they're not supposed to be secret."
Simeon closed his mouth again. If he demanded to know how Murdo had found out, he would himself face questions about why he had kept the secret. Murdo went on,
"And the farm at Lynn was donated to the priory by..."
He paused for dramatic effect.
"Queen Isabella," he finished.
Godwin looked around. There was consternation among the monks, all but Carlos and Simeon, who both looked stone-faced. Friar Murdo leaned across the table. Green herbs from the dinner-time stew adhered to his teeth.
"I ask you again," he said aggressively, "did you receive your wound in the service of Queen Isabella?"
Thomas said, "Everyone knows what I did before I was a monk. I was a knight. I fought battles. I killed men. I have confessed and received absolution."
"A monk may put his past behind him, but the prior of Kingsbridge carries a heavier burden. He may be asked who he killed, and why, and, most importantly, what reward he received."
Thomas stared back at Murdo without speaking. Godwin tried to read Thomas's face. It was rigidly set in an expression of some strong emotion. But what? There was no sign of guilt or even embarrassment. Whatever the secret was, Thomas did not feel he had done something shameful. The look was not rage, either. Murdo's sneering tone might have provoked many men to violence, but Thomas did not look as if he were about to lash out. No. What Thomas seemed to be feeling was something different, colder than embarrassment, quieter than rage. It was, Godwin realized at last, fear. Thomas was afraid.
Of Murdo?
Hardly. No, he feared something that might happen because of Murdo, some consequence of Murdo's having discovered the secret. Murdo continued like a dog with a bone.
"If you don't answer the question here in this room, it will be asked elsewhere."
Godwin's calculations called for Thomas to give up at this point, but it was not a certainty. Thomas was tough. For 10 years he had shown himself to be quiet, patient, and resilient. When approached by Godwin to stand as prior, he must have decided that the past could be buried.
He must now realize he had been wrong. But how would he react to that realization? Would he see his mistake and back away? Or would he grit his teeth and see it through? Godwin bit his lip and waited. Thomas spoke at last. "I think you may be right about the question being asked elsewhere," he said. "Or, at least, I think you will do everything in your power, no matter how unbrotherly or dangerous, to make your forecast come true."
"I don't know if you're implying—"
"You need say no more," Thomas said, rising abruptly to his feet. Murdo recoiled. Thomas's height and soldierly physique, combined with a sharp rise in his voice, achieved the rare result of silencing the friar.
"I have never answered questions about my past," Thomas said.
His voice was quiet again, and every monk in the room was still and silent, straining to hear.
"I never will."
He pointed at Murdo. "But this slug makes me realize that if I became your prior, such questions would never cease. A monk may keep his past to himself, but a prior is different, I now see. A prior may have enemies, and any mystery is a weakness. And then, of course, by the leader's vulnerability, the institution itself is threatened. My brain should have led me where Friar Murdo's malice led him, to the conclusion that a man who does not want to answer questions about his past cannot be a prior. Therefore," young Theodoric said, "no! Therefore, I now withdraw my candidacy in the coming election." Godwin breathed a long sigh of satisfaction. He had achieved his object. Thomas sat down. Murdo looked smug, and everyone else tried to speak at the same time. Carlos banged the table, and slowly they quietened down. He said, "Friar Murdo, as you don't have a vote in this election, I must ask you to leave us now." Murdo slowly walked out, looking triumphant. When he had gone, Carlos said,
"This is a catastrophe. Murdo the only candidate."
Theodoric said, "Thomas cannot be allowed to withdraw."
"But he has."
Simeon said,
"There must be another candidate."
"Yes," said Carlos, "and I propose Simeon."
"No," said Theodoric.
"Let me speak," said Simeon. "We must choose the one among us who is most certain to unite the brethren against Murdo. That is not myself. I know I don't have enough backing among the youngsters. I think we all know who would gather most support from all sections."
He turned and looked at Godwin.
"Yes,"
Theodoric said.
"Godwin!"
The younger monks cheered, and the older ones looked resigned. Godwin shook his head, as if reluctant even to respond to them. They began to bang the tables and chant his name.
"Godwin! Godwin!"
At last he stood up. His heart was full of elation, but he kept his face straight. He held up his hands for quiet. Then, when the room was silent, he said in a low, modest voice,
"I shall obey the will of my brethren."
The room erupted in cheering. Chapter 23. Godwin delayed the election. Earl Roland was going to be angry at the result, and Godwin wanted to give him as little time as possible to fight the decision before the wedding. The truth was that Godwin was frightened. He was going up against one of the most powerful men in the kingdom. There were only 13 earls. Together with about 40 lesser barons, 21 bishops, and a handful of others, they governed England. When the king summoned Parliament, they were the lords, the aristocratic group, by contrast with the commons, who were knights, gentry, and merchants. The Earl of Shiring was one of the more powerful and prominent men of his class, and yet Brother Godwin, aged 31, son of the widow Petronilla, who had risen no higher than sacrist of Kingsbridge Priory, was in conflict with the Earl, and, what was even more dangerous, he was winning. So he dithered. But 6 days before the wedding, Roland put his foot down and said,
"Tomorrow!"
Guests were already arriving for the nuptials. The Earl of Monmouth had moved into the hospital, using the private room next to Roland's. Lord William and Lady Philippa had had to remove to the Bell Inn. Bishop Richard was sharing the prior's house with Carlos. Lesser barons and knights filled the taverns, along with their wives and children, squires and servants and horses. The town enjoyed a surge of spending, much needed after the disappointing profits from the rain-drenched fleece fair. On the morning of the election, Godwin and Simeon went to the treasury, a small windowless room behind a heavy oak door off the library. The precious ornaments used for special services were there, locked in an iron-bound chest. Simeon, as treasurer, held the keys. The election was a foregone conclusion, or so thought everyone except Earl Roland. No one suspected Godwin's hidden hand. He had suffered one tense moment when Thomas had wondered aloud how Friar Murdo got to know about the Isabella Charter.
"He can't have discovered it accidentally. He's never been seen reading in the library. And anyway, that deed isn't kept with the others," Thomas had said to Godwin. "Someone must have told him about it. But who? Only Carlos and Simeon knew of it. Why would they have let the secret out? They didn't want to help Murdo."
Godwin had said nothing, and Thomas had remained baffled. Godwin and Simeon dragged the treasure chest into the light of the library. The cathedral jewels were wrapped in blue cloth and cushioned in protective sheets of leather. As they sorted through the box, Simeon unwrapped some of the items, admiring them and checking that they were undamaged. There was a plaque a few inches wide made of ivory, delicately carved, showing the crucifixion of St. Adolphus, at which the saint had asked God to grant good health and long life to all those who venerated his memory. There were numerous candlesticks and crucifixes, all of gold or silver, most decorated with precious stones. In the strong light from the tall library windows, the gems glittered and the gold glowed. These things had been given to the priory over the centuries by devout worshippers. Their combined value was awesome. There was more wealth here than most people ever saw in one place. Godwin had come for a ceremonial crozier, or shepherd's crook, made of wood encased in gold, with an elaborately jeweled handle. This was ritually handed to the new prior at the end of the election process. The crook was at the bottom of the chest, not having been used for 15 years. As Godwin drew it out, Simeon let out an exclamation. Godwin looked up sharply. Simeon was holding a large crucifix on a stand, intended to be placed on an altar. "What's the matter?" Godwin said. Simeon showed him the back of the cross, and pointed to a shallow, cup-shaped indentation just below the crosspiece. Godwin immediately saw that a ruby was missing. "It must have fallen out," he said. He glanced around the library. They were alone. They were both worried. As treasurer and sacrist, they shared responsibility. They would be blamed for any loss. Together they examined every item in the chest. They unwrapped each one and shook out every blue cloth. They looked at all the leather sheets. Frantically they scrutinized the empty box and the floor all around. The ruby was nowhere to be seen. Simeon said, "When was the crucifix last used?" "At the feast of St. Adolphus, when Carlos fell. He knocked it off the table." "Perhaps the ruby fell out then. But how is it possible that no one noticed? The stone was on the back of the cross, but surely someone would have seen it on the floor. Who picked up the crucifix?" "I don't remember," Godwin said quickly. The situation was confused. In fact, he remembered perfectly well. It was Philemon. Godwin could picture the scene. Philemon and Otho together had righted the altar, setting it squarely on its platform. Then Otho had picked up the candlesticks, and Philemon the cross. With a growing feeling of dismay, Godwin recalled the disappearance of Lady Philippa's bracelet. Had Philemon stolen again? He trembled to think how it might affect him. Everyone knew that Philemon was Godwin's unofficial acolyte. Such a dreadful sin,
Stealing a jewel from a sacred ornament would bring shame on everyone associated with the perpetrator. It could easily upset the election. Simeon obviously did not recollect the scene exactly, and he accepted without question Godwin's feigned inability to remember who had picked up the cross. But others among the monks would surely recall seeing it in Philemon's hands. Godwin had to put this right quickly, before suspicion could fall on Philemon. But first, he had to get Simeon out of the way.
"We must search for the ruby in the church," Simeon said.
"But the service was 2 weeks ago," Godwin protested.
"A ruby can't have lain on the floor unnoticed for that length of time. It's unlikely, but we must check."
Godwin saw that he had to go with Simeon and wait for an opportunity to get away from him and seek out Philemon.
"Of course," he said.
They put the ornaments away and locked the treasury door. As they left the library, Godwin said,
"I suggest we say nothing about this until we're sure the jewel has been lost. No point in bringing blame on our heads prematurely."
"Agreed."
They hurried around the cloisters and entered the church. They stood in the center of the crossing and scanned the ground all around them. A month ago, the idea that a ruby could lie hidden somewhere on the church floor would have been more plausible, but recently the flagstones had been repaired and the cracks and chips had disappeared. A ruby would have stood out.
Simeon said, "Now that I come to think of it, wasn't it Philemon who picked up the crucifix?"
Godwin looked at Simeon's face. Was there accusation in the expression? He could not tell.
"It may have been Philemon," Godwin said.
Then he saw a chance to get away.
"I'll go and fetch him," he suggested.
"Perhaps he will be able to recall exactly where he was standing at the time."
"Good idea. I'll wait here."
Simeon got down on his knees and began to pat the floor with his hands, as if the ruby might be found by touch more easily than by sight. Godwin hurried out. He went first to the dormitory. The blanket cupboard was in the same place. He pulled it away from the wall, found the loose stone, and removed it. He put his hand into the hidey hole where Philemon had stashed Lady Philippa's bracelet. He found nothing there. He cursed. It was not going to be that easy. "I'll have to dismiss Philemon from the monastery," he thought, as he strode through the priory buildings looking for him. "If he has stolen this ruby, I can't cover up for him again. He's out." Then he realized, with a shock of dismay, that he could not dismiss Philemon. Not now, perhaps not ever. It was Philemon who had told Friar Murdo about the Isabella Charter. If dismissed, Philemon could confess what he had done, and reveal that he had done it at Godwin's instigation. And he would be believed. Godwin recalled Thomas's puzzling over who had told Murdo the secret and why. Philemon's revelation would gain conviction by answering that question. There would be an outcry at such underhand work. Even if the disclosure were made after the election, it would undermine Godwin's authority and cripple his ability to lead the monks. The ominous truth dawned on him that he now had to protect Philemon in order to protect himself. He found Philemon sweeping the hospital floor. He beckoned him outside and led him around to the back of the kitchen, where it was unlikely that anyone would see them. He looked Philemon in the eye and said, "There's a ruby missing." Philemon looked away.
"How terrible."
"It's from the altar crucifix that was knocked to the floor when Carlos fell over." Philemon pretended innocence.
"How could it have gone missing?"
"The ruby may have become dislodged when the crucifix hit the floor, but it's not on the floor now. I've just looked. Someone found it and kept it."
"Surely not."
Godwin felt angered by Philemon's false air of innocence.
"You fool! Everyone saw you pick up that crucifix."
Philemon's voice rose to a higher pitch.
"I know nothing about it." "Don't waste time lying to me. We have to put this right. I could lose the election on your account."
Godwin pushed Philemon up against the wall of the bakehouse.
Where is it?
To his astonishment, Philemon began to cry.
For the love of the saints,
Godwin said disgustedly, stop this nonsense.
You're a grown man.
Philemon continued to sob. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry. If you don't stop that... Godwin checked himself. Nothing was to be gained by berating Philemon. The man was truly pathetic. Speaking more gently, he said, try to pull yourself together. Where is the ruby?
I hid it.
Yes?
In the refectory chimney.
Godwin immediately turned away, heading for the refectory.
Mary, save us. It could fall into the fire.
Philemon followed, his tears drying.
There's no fire in August. I would have moved it before the cold weather.
They entered the refectory. At one end of the long room was a wide fireplace. Philemon put his arm up the chimney and fumbled for a moment. Then he produced a ruby the size of a sparrow's egg, covered with soot. He wiped it clean on his sleeve. Godwin took it. Now, come with me, he said.
What are we going to do?
Simeon is going to find this. They went to the church. Simeon was still searching on hands and knees. Now, Godwin said to Philemon, try to remember exactly where you were when you picked up the crucifix. Simeon looked at Philemon and, seeing signs of emotion on his face, spoke kindly to him.
Don't be afraid, lad. You've done nothing wrong.
Philemon positioned himself on the east side of the crossing, close to the steps leading up to the chancel.
I think it was here, he said.
Godwin climbed the two steps and looked under the choir stalls, pretending to search. Surreptitiously he placed the ruby under one of the rows of seats, close to the near end, where it was not visible to a casual glance. Then, as if changing his mind about the likeliest place to look, he moved to the south side of the chancel. Come and search under here, Philemon, he said. As he had hoped, Simeon then moved to the north side and got down on his knees to look under the stalls, murmuring a prayer as he did so. Godwin expected Simeon to see the ruby immediately. He pretended to search the south aisle, waiting for Simeon to find it. He began to think there must be something wrong with Simeon's eyesight. He might have to go over there and find it himself. Then at last Simeon called out,
Oh, here!
Godwin pretended to be excited.
Have you found it?
Yes! Hallelujah!
Where was it?
Here, under the choir stalls.
Praise be to God, said Godwin. Godwin told himself not to be frightened of Earl Rowland. As he climbed the stone stairs of the hospital to the guest rooms, he asked himself what the Earl could do to him. Even if Rowland had been capable of getting out of his bed and drawing a sword, he would not be foolish enough to attack a monk within the precincts of a monastery. Even a king would hardly get away with that. Ralph Fitzgerald announced him, and he went into the room. The Earl's sons stood either side of the bed. Tall William, in soldierly brown hose and muddy boots, his hair already receding from his forehead, and Richard, in bishop's purple, his growing roundness of figure evidence of a sybaritic nature and the means to indulge it. William was 30, a year younger than Godwin. He had his father's strength of will, but it was sometimes softened by the influence of his wife, Philippa. Richard was 28, and presumably took after his late mother, for he had little of the Earl's imposing bearing and forcefulness.
"Well, monk,"
said the Earl, speaking out of the left side of his mouth,
have you held your little election?
Godwin suffered a moment of resentment for this discourteous form of address. One day, he vowed silently, Rowland would call him Father Prior. Indignation gave him the courage he needed to tell the Earl the news.
We have, Lord, he said. I have the honour to tell you that the monks of Kingsbridge have chosen me as their prior.
What?
The Earl bellowed.
You!
Godwin bowed his head in an affectation of humility.
No one could be more surprised than I.
You're nothing but a boy!
The insult stung Godwin into a rejoinder. I'm older than your son, the Bishop of Kingsbridge.
How many votes did you get?
25.
And how many for Friar Murdo?
None. The monks were unanimous.
None!
Roland roared.
There must have been a conspiracy. This is treason!
The election was held in strict accordance with the rules.
I don't care a pig's prick for your rules. I won't be ignored by a bunch of effeminate monks.
I am the choice of my brothers, my lord. The inauguration ceremony will be held this coming Sunday, before the wedding.
The monk's choice must be ratified by the Bishop of Kingsbridge, and I can tell you he will not ratify you. Rerun the election, and this time bring me the result I want.
Very good, Earl Roland. Godwin went to the door. He had several more cards in his hand, but he was not going to lay them on the table all at once. He turned and addressed Richard. My Lord Bishop, when you wish to speak to me about this, you will find me in the Prior's house. He stepped outside.
You're not the Prior!
Roland shouted as he shut the door. Godwin was trembling. Roland was formidable, especially when angry, and he was often angry. But Godwin had stood his ground. Petronilla would be proud of him. He went down the stairs on shaky legs and made his way to the Prior's house. Carlos had already moved out. For the first time in 15 years, Godwin would have a bedroom to himself. His pleasure was only slightly damped by having to share the place with the bishop, who traditionally stayed there while visiting. The bishop was, technically, the abbot of Kingsbridge ex officio, and though his power was limited, his status was above that of the prior. Richard was rarely in the house during the day, but returned every night to sleep in the best bedroom. Godwin entered the ground floor hall and sat in the big chair, waiting. It would not be long before Bishop Richard appeared, his ears burning with his father's scorching instructions. Richard was a rich and powerful man, but not frightening in the way the Earl was. All the same, it was a bold monk who defied his bishop. However, Godwin had an advantage in this confrontation, for he knew something shameful about Richard, and that was as good as a knife up his sleeve. Richard bustled in a few minutes later, showing a confidence that Godwin knew to be faked.
"I've struck a bargain for you," he said without preamble. "You can be sub-prior under Murdo. You'll be in charge of day-to-day management of the priory. Murdo doesn't want to be an administrator anyway. He just wants the prestige. You'll have all the power, but my father will be satisfied."
"Let me get this straight," said Godwin. "Murdo agrees to make me his sub-prior. Then we tell the rest of the monks that he is the only one you'll ratify, and you think they will accept that."
"They have no choice."
"I have an alternative suggestion. Tell the Earl that the monks will not have anyone but me, and that I must be ratified before the wedding, otherwise the monks will not take part in the nuptials. The nuns, too, will refuse." Godwin did not know whether the monks would go along with this, let alone Mother Cecilia and the nuns, but he was too far gone for caution.
"They wouldn't dare."
"I'm afraid they would." Richard looked panicky.
"My father won't be bullied."
Godwin laughed. "Small chance of that, but I hope he may be made to see reason.
He'll say the wedding must go ahead anyway. I'm the bishop. I can marry the couple. I don't need monks to help me."
"Of course. But there will be no singing, no candles, no psalms, no incense. Just you and Archdeacon Lloyd."
"They will still be married.
How will the Earl of Monmouth feel about such a mean wedding for his son?"
"He'll be furious, but he'll accept it. The alliance is the important thing."
That was probably right, Godwin thought, and he felt the cold draft of imminent failure.
It was time to draw his concealed knife.
"You owe me a kindness," he said.
At first, Richard pretended not to know what he was talking about.
"Do I? I concealed the sin you committed. Don't pretend to have forgotten. It was only 3 months ago."
"Ah, yes. That was generous of you.
I saw with my own eyes you and Marjorie on the bed in the guest room."
"Hush, for pity's sake!"
"Now is your chance to repay me that kindness. Intercede with your father. Tell him to give in. Argue that the wedding is more important. Insist on ratifying me."
Richard's face